About This Podcast. Your hosts, Ed Hammond and Diego Kaminker, talk with global leaders in healthcare informatics about the evolution, current status, and future of healthcare interoperability in their regions and worldwide. This podcast is sponsored by EMEA IASI and HL7 International and is produced by HL7 Argentina. Ed and Diego select 5 questions for their guests and then let them answer freely. The questions are randomly chosen live from a longer list, so they'll be surprised and their guests will be surprised too. About our sponsors. About the Academy. The International Academy of Health Sciences Informatics was established in 2017 under the auspices of EMEA, the International Medical Informatics Association. It promotes the dissemination of informatics-based knowledge and best practices, fosters new ideas, and encourages worldwide collaboration and sharing of expertise and resources. About HL7 International. Founded in 1987, Health Level 7 International is a not-for-profit, ANSI-accredited, standards-developing organization. HL7 is supported by more than 1,600 members from over 50 countries, including 500-plus corporate members. About HL7 Argentina. HL7 Argentina was founded in 1999, making it one of the oldest HL7 affiliates. HL7 Argentina created the HL7 Fire Fundamentals course, which has educated about 7,000 students in HL7 standards worldwide since 2008. A little about your hosts. Diego Kaminker has defined, implemented, and maintained hundreds of healthcare interoperability projects using the major HL7 standards. He's an Academy Fellow and is currently an Affiliate Director on the HL7 International Board. Ed Hammond is Chair Emeritus and Founder of HL7 International, Chair of the Standards Panel of EMEA-IASI, and creator of the original HL7 Messaging Standard. For more details, be sure to check out the podcast notes.
Hello, Ed, and welcome to New Orleans.
Hello, Diego. It's fun to be here again with a new guest.
Yes, we have today in our podcast, Paula Brown. Paula, welcome.
Thank you, Diego.
Hi, Paula.
Hi, Ed.
Well, Paula was the first entrepreneur in residence at the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. She has been recognized as one of the top 50 influencers in the federal government on artificial intelligence and helped to launch the Helios Fire Accelerator for Public Health. She is an internationally recognized expert on interoperability and innovation, and she collaborates with colleagues from across the government and private industry to use design thinking and advances in technology to help address real-world health challenges. Wow.
That sounds impressive.
What a guest. Okay. Paula, our first question is always the same for all our guests. The other questions are randomly selected by our fortune wheel. So the first question is, how did you become involved in healthcare interoperability standards and what was your drive?
Yeah, great question. About 8 years ago, when I started back at CDC as the entrepreneur in residence, I had a challenge in front of me. It was, how do we think about public health interoperability? And specifically, how could we improve the timeliness and the quality and the usability of death data, you know, data captured on death certificates? And that seemed like a ostensibly very simple task. And then I realized there was a much, much more complexity to it. And because I was an entrepreneur in residence, I came in to the government at the same time as a number of great people. Mark Scrimshire was at CMS at that time. Adam Culbertson was at ONC and HIMSS. And I would hear them talking about this new thing called FHIR. And I had no idea what it was. So I had a sticky note and a pen, and I wrote to myself, FHIR, F-I-R-E, figure it out. But as I began to learn more about the standard, mostly through Mark Bronstein at Georgia Tech and the coursework that he had made available to the public, I developed a great appreciation for all that had happened over the previous 2-3 decades and began to see that whether it's death data or any other public health data, it's just a web of networks. And if it's a network, then you have nodes and you have connections among those nodes. And so what would be those most important and strategic nodes to strengthen first? And what would be the standards that you would use to help not just get the data into the node, but really think about exchanging among the nodes. And so that's when it became clear to me that the FHIR standard was going to be really important. And then just another kind of happenstance, I was at an event that Adam had sponsored up in Cleveland, and Graham was sitting next to me. And I just introduced myself to him. I didn't know who he was, didn't know him from Adam. We just kind of became friends and colleagues from that point forward. And so being involved in trying to improve something that most people thought would just be forever intractable, and being able to do it in a community like HL7 and the Global FHIR community, has just been a real honor.
So your first contact with healthcare information in interoperability was about death certificates.
Yeah. Where you die and how you die determines.
It's very interesting because we are always thinking on how to improve the patient health after the encounter.
Yeah.
And we cannot improve anything here.
Well, you know, I think that's a view that a lot of people have. And the more that I was involved with death data, and particularly the medical legal death investigation community, so that's if you die of a car accident or a violent death, like a homicide or a suicide, there's a whole different trained set of professionals that investigate and certify your death.
We can improve other people's
right
death.
And so there's a quote at the medical examiner's office in New York City. It's in Latin, so I'll probably mess up the translation, but it's effectively, we're here to help protect the living because of what's learned on the autopsy table.
So let me ask you a question. One is whether the problem has been solved. Do we still have accurate and timely death data? And two, the reason somebody dies, maybe like pneumonia, but the pneumonia is a consequence of the underlying disease. And you're thinking, is there a distinction between, how do we really know what the impact of the disease is if on death, rather than it's the cause of death? Is that part of what you looked at?
Yeah, it's funny. I haven't talked about this in a while because this is 8 years ago when I was brought back. But to answer your first question directly, we haven't solved it, but it's improving. The work that I helped to start with the National Center for Health Statistics is still ongoing. They were just here at Connectathon, at the FHIR Connectathon. And I think my vision got a little bit ahead of where the technology was at the time. But because of the dedication of, hundreds of people across the country and across the globe, they're moving closer to an actual state where information is being exchanged, not so much by paper records that sort of sunset a while ago.
What I saw is that you are trying to actually extracting information from the EHR.
Yeah, that was the next
as much information as you can, maybe not.
Yeah.
But, and how successful you think you have been?
So when we initially tried to do it, that's when right after Google had released its deep model languages or deep learning. And that was so cool because the data was effectively, the models were iteratively being built off the data. You weren't training it in the same way that you would train a normal artificial intelligence model at that time. So Ed, to your question, there is a really important distinction between the immediate cause of death and the underlying cause.
Yes.
And so the goal, what we were trying to do then, and it was a bit of a stretch, but we were trying to say, given these FHIR APIs that we knew were coming down the pike, could we layer an artificial intelligence tool on top of that to mine through all of the data that's available, filter out different sequences that seem to be probably the most probable causal sequence, and then make it easier for the clinician to really come up with that differential diagnosis.
So that's applied to a specific case?
That was the hope, right? Let's say some natural cause and I'm dead. They would be able to ping the places where I had my records. This was what we're hoping to create. And then be able to sequence it and say, okay, this happened and this happened and this happened and then this happened and then this happened and then this happened. And so there's sort of known causal relationships among disease. And there's a lot of work that's been done in this area, mostly to protect the living, but could it also be applied to better ascertain that underlying cause of death?
So let me ask you another question. I don't want to lock onto question one so much, but
that's okay. We're kind of touching all the
other, but
we are we are free. We are a free podcast.
Okay, this didn't matter because I always do that anyway.
Yeah, we know you do whatever you wanted.
that's the final answer.
The question I was going to ask you is what is the primary reason why we have difficulty in identifying death data, and particularly where somebody is dead or alive. What is the primary reason that we cannot, even within the EHRs, be correct, at least who's dead and who's not dead?
So in the United States, the system of record for death is actually distributed across 57 vital records jurisdictions. And there's state-specific laws about who can access that data. And so there's not always a feedback loop. There generally is not a feedback loop to the places that cared for the individuals. So you can infer death and stop showing up, but you don't know death. And the only way you would know it would be to either have a reason and authorized use for connecting against the National Death Index, which is typically for research purposes, or on a state-by-state basis, connecting with the death registry.
Yeah, I have experience in that. I helped a country to create their tumor registry, and they connected the tumor registry with the death certificate. So they know if one of the patients that is being followed has been, and they also created, because this is difficult, a way that if the patient goes to any hospital in the network, they know that the patient is alive yet. Mm-hmm. So to your question.
I still haven't got what I want, the point that I want to make, and I'll do that now because we did research at Duke, and we found out that Duke is one of the most miraculous academic medical centers in the world because we found that Duke brought lots of people back to life. We have people that have people that have date of death, and they keep having encounters after that. And so it makes me proud to be a Duke person. But again, it's my pet peeve, and that's the fact of the lack of a personal identifier for a patient that we can lock those together. Yeah. And particularly when you're mixing databases together, as we brought in a clinic, for example, and I think their error rate was probably somewhere in the vicinity of 40%.
Wow.
And put them together, and that's one of the factors, but it's not unique.
Haven't thought about the unique identifier when you die, because most countries have a unique identifier.
Except the U.S.
And in the U.S. you use your driver license or something like that to register?
So the death certificate will contain identifiable information that is unique. It's just in the United States, whether that's used in healthcare, typically not. And so how do you stand against the death registry?
Okay, let's finish this question.
Okay, let's go.
let's pick one.
Big money.
Right, we'll take the next question.
It's number four.
Okay, what's number four?
Number four is, which is your vision for healthcare interoperability in your group, country, region, or globally, whatever you want to talk about?
When I think about interoperability, it just boils down to, do you have what you need when you need it so you can make a decision, make a tough call? And I'll restrict it to the United States first. I think what I see happening in the United States is that more and more people are having more opportunities to get care. And it seems counterintuitive because you hear all these things about rural hospitals closing and it's just becoming dire. I'm also seeing a shift that I find very promising. When I go to the grocery store, I see a blood pressure cuff there that people can sit down and get some of the most vital signs available to them. I go to a big box store and I can get my glasses there. And I think there's just certain services that people wouldn't always necessarily prioritize for themselves. But when it's accessible like that, when it's integrated into things that they do every day, every week, I actually think for large segments of the population, there's probably better uptake of simple things like that that can have a longer impact on their health trajectory than very expensive medical care in a brick and mortar institution. And so now the question is, as care becomes increasingly decentralized, then how is it that those bits and bytes can be accumulated in a meaningful way and be used over the course of that individual's lifespan? So I think, for the longest time, when we thought about healthcare interoperability, it's really been centered around the institution. And I think in order to make that shift, it really needs to cater to the individual. And how do we think about with a $20 device that you might pick up that you use to make phone calls and surf the internet and text your friends. How could something like that also be an integral part of understanding your own health and being able to take that information with you? This is how I'm insured. You know, this is what I'm covered for. These are the things that I can do to help me become more healthy. I think that what's exciting about FHIR is it works on those kinds of devices just as well as it works on the major mainframes at places like Duke, right? And so it's shifting things in ways. And it gives me hope that that same kind of care delivery can extend much broader globally to places where it would have been really difficult just to have basic information about your own health. And I think Dan Vreeman showed me the other day, Africa had posted that if you're going to do new builds, it should be using FHIR.
Yeah, it's in the new Africa CDC rules that they have just released last week.
And we saw the presentation yesterday about what's happening with Haiti, just because of code that was developed here in the global FHIR community was made accessible. And that gives me a great deal of optimism.
So how unique is interoperability? I mean, you're describing it in a way that somebody else would describe it differently.
I describe a lot of things differently from most people, Ed.
I don't mean that as a negative, but part of what I'm really is to what degree is interoperability possible? I mean, Diego and I argue about what is possible a little bit, and your definition of interoperability focused on a particular thing, it's to me at least. Yeah. And I guess part of that is really you're giving a lot more responsibility and knowledge to a patient of knowing how to deal with the data that they're measuring themselves.
I disagree. She said at the beginning that interoperability is making the information available to make decision to someone.
She have one important piece of that, and that's understandable.
Yeah,
that's the key to that.
It was very interesting, the understandable part, because we don't care about our insurance, and maybe I'm talking in general, until we need it.
Yeah,
I agree.
So how can I understand the fine paper that I signed?
Yeah.
That's part of making the information available for the patient in a way that they will understand.
If it's not clear and understandable, it's not interoperable in my mind. So what I'm seeing is that the seemingly impossible is becoming increasingly probable as technology continues to advance. And I think we're in the era now, everybody's worried about homicidic cyborgs taking over the earth. And as long as we create a little more than we destroy with every step forward, then from my perspective, it can be a net good. It's just hard to imagine a positive outcome. We actually kind of really suck at it as a society.
Let me ask a question, maybe stretch to put it within this category.
Yeah.
But one of the things that continues to amaze me is the advertising the pharmaceutical industry does on television. And how does the concept of interoperability fit into that? I mean, patients go to the doctor and demand that they prescribe this particular drug that's been advertised on television for their problem. And if this doctor won't do it, they go to another problem. There's so much data out there. I was going to use the word information, but I'm not sure that's a proper word. But how does that fit within what you're talking about with concepts of interoperability? Interoperability takes more than just data. It's the use of that data. It's the timing of that data. It's knowing that what the next step is. I mean, I measure my blood pressure is 160. You know, do I go sit in the chair or do I rush to the hospital? I mean, you must incorporate some idea of the knowledge and understanding on the part of the individual to be able to properly react to the spreading of data collection in those manners.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's complex. There's again, not a simple answer here. And the advertisement of pharmaceuticals in the United States existed long before the kinds of FHIR-based interoperability that we have today and the creative things that it can enable. I think that it boils down, there's a difference between advertisement and marketing. And Seth Godin has drawn that distinction. Advertising is exactly what you're describing. You spam people, you have your selfish needs, you put it out in front of them, you know, you watch, do they buy the thing you want them to buy? We can go on and on about the merits of
that. And we use AI to help.
And at the same time, marketing, permission marketing is, am I getting information that's anticipated? Is it helpful? Do I trust the source? And I think that's a different kind of conversation. And so will there always be forces in a capitalist society looking out for themselves instead of the net of the population? Absolutely. But does that have to be the preordained answer? No. And what I see that's different now is the kinds of tools that are increasingly being made available to the hobbyist and to the average citizen, put them on the exact same playing field as those organizations and institutions with deep pockets and selfish interests. And so if there's any kind of an antidote to that dynamic, it's really around thinking about how do we harness the power of the hive in ways that people can do the kinds of things we do here at HL7, collaborate, sometimes even with our direct competitors, toward a common good, toward a kind of a baseline level that's going to help us advance. And I think that when we have enough people who learn kind of basic things, we're all primates, monkey see, monkey do. So if Diego does something and I feel a little bit fear of missing out, I want to do the cool thing that Diego's done, right?
And you can do a podcast now.
Yeah, exactly.
we could talk forever on each of these questions. So I depend on Diego moving us along.
They cut us off.
So the next question comes with this one is, how do you see steps for realizing your vision, and if there's a known pathway?
Well, I think we're creating the pathway together, quite honestly. I think that the early work that Apple and Google and others did to make sure that the data that it was mapped to the FHIR standard is available on phones is a very important first step, but it's not enough. I mean, what are you gonna do? It's like, oh, I've got my data. Okay, well, what do you do with it? Well, it's broken. I think about when my youngest brother got married, my oldest nephew at that time was about 3 years old. And my mother was taking pictures with one of those old, you know, disposable cameras. And he asked, Grandma, what's that? And she goes, it's a camera. He goes, well, let me see it. Let me see the picture. And then she just laughed. And she goes, no, it's not that kind of camera. And he took it and he flipped it around because he was sure that LED screen, he could see that picture of himself. It wasn't there. And then he started shaking it. He just saw
I like that story.
Where's the picture, Grandma? And I think that's kind of where we are. It's like, okay, well, I have my data. Well, what am I going to do with it? The immediacy, personalization, filtering out what's relevant, what's not relevant. None of us can do that on our own. Doctors can't even do that on their own. Even the most advanced ones still rely on kind of pools of information to help us decipher all of this. And I think that's, I hope that that's the trajectory we're on, that people will help people like them, communities that they care deeply about, to kind of figure it all out.
So two comments, two questions for you related to this, going back to the other question as well, because I've made the comment several times that interoperability requires more than data standards.
Yeah.
Do you think that is a correct statement?
Absolutely, because if it's not understandable, if it's not usable, if you can't decipher the context, then it's like having a camera that you can't see your picture on it.
And I think that's one of the things that HL7 has a responsibility of understanding, that FHIR itself has a particular purpose. It makes it easy to do to increase the impact of data. But it does take more than that. And I think a lot of people expect FHIR to be the answer to everything. And
yeah.
Because we almost sell it sometimes. I do as well. But at the bottom line, I think it's one of the critical and key components of interoperability, but it doesn't in itself guarantee.
But I think of FHIR as like the alphabet. You're standardizing on a composable level so that way little bits and bytes can be assembled and reassembled in useful ways. So if FHIR gets you the alphabet, FHIR gets you some of the paradigms on how to construct a word, and we have some agreements about how you create a sentence, then from there, it enables a level of interoperability that would have been very, very difficult to do with pipe delimited files or with documents, you know, for example.
Or without APIs.
Without APIs. Because it's that composability piece of it, I think, that is really instrumental to the value added component.
Yeah, but we are also discussing, and I was in a meeting two days ago on how many levels of profiling, because a profile is just how to create the sentences and for each domain. So how many levels of these definitions are used or will be used or are reasonable or we can support. So I think we are going slowly beyond just the alphabet and the sentences on a thesaurus. We have all this already, and he's working on that too.
Yeah.
So, we have more than that. We have also these libraries of sentences that you can use.
Yeah.
Because that will speed up our processes a lot.
Yeah.
Instead of thinking again about the sentences, just have these pre-cooked sentences to choose from. Okay, let's go to our next question.
Are we gonna roll the wheel?
Always.
Yay.
We need to add a question, by the way, on IPS to our set.
It's number 13.
Oh, double digit.
Yeah, double digit. How did the pandemic change your view about health IT standards? What would be the change that you will impose 5 years ago to improve reporting and follow up in your region?
Yeah, I mean, the past few years inside of CDC has given me a whole new way of thinking about interoperability and why it matters. And it was redolent of the time that I spent at the US embassies in Iraq and Afghanistan from 2009 to 2011. And one of the greatest honors that I had was the United States Digital Service came to work with CDC during the height of the pandemic. And I went out to the field with them as a kind of a trusted advisor. And what we saw there was, again, all of these labs, all these vaccination sites. First we saw the labs, and then it was later after the vaccine was available that obviously that the vaccination sites. But people were getting life-saving information and life-saving therapeutics and, you know, vaccines in like giant stadiums, and they were getting them in little grocery stores. And how do you get that information to flow? If you had experience doing lab reporting and you could do a V2 feed, great. But many of these partners just came in because it was an all hands on deck, all of government, all of industry response to something that impacted all of us. And so beginning to think through, how do you actually get the data collection right? So that way they're not hurting their wrist and developing carpal tunnel syndrome from having administered shots, thousands of shots a day, and then having to fill out paper forms.
That's the physical world.
Yeah, like how you collect data has a direct impact on the next patient's care in that context. And I remember going to, very early on in the pandemic, we were at a long-term care facility in Texas, and we were head to toe in our protective equipment because still didn't know a whole lot about the transmission dynamics. And the people who worked there, they had set up a makeshift COVID testing lab with the rapid test that had just been issued. And they literally, these were some of the earliest rapid tests that went out. And we were in the beauty salon, and we saw this woman, because they were testing the staff as they came in. And she had them all lined up, and she had all of these different timers. And it was this whole workflow that nobody would have ever imagined that a lab workflow would look like that. And so what we did working with the United States Digital Service was to create a tool that incorporated things like the timer into them, that incorporated the ability to kind of preload unknown populations. That way you wouldn't have to enter the same information over and over again. It connected to a hub that could be used to send the data to multiple endpoints in public health. So you didn't have to call your local health department when you faxed it to the state and you did the hokey pokey and turned yourself around however many hundreds of times a day. And building off of that, we created the ability to map the incoming feed, no matter what it was, a CSV, V2, et cetera, to FHIR. So you'd have kind of consistent data representation and consistent metadata that you could derive from it, and then, you know, continue to send it on. And so I think each one of those little snippets combined together can create very sophisticated workflows. But it was sitting down face to face with people who are working 15-20 hour days.
I have a follow-up question. Suppose yesterday the World Health Organization declared the end of the emergency because of COVID. What is your thoughts about if something like this happens 1 week from now again? All this work that you did is lost and you have to do it again, or it was incorporated into the protocols?
I'd say a lot of what's built has been extensible. We also have the huge capacity to learn. There's a lot of muscle memory that's kind of fresh. There's additional enhancements that are being made to the public health infrastructure. It would be interesting to see what would happen. I hope we're not in a situation where we face something like we did with COVID. I think it's going to take public health as a community a while to recover from it. I think just the emotional exhaustion of doing this work for the last 3 years, it takes time. When I was in Iraq and Afghanistan, they told us every year that you're there, it'll take you about 2 years to recover. And so it wouldn't surprise me if it's going to take the better part of a decade for a lot of people to come back and start to feel like themselves again.
So, in my opinion, part of the problem with COVID is the fact that there was misinformation or confused information, and you had as many people that worried about getting the vaccination as they did about worried about getting the disease. I mean, the difficult thing was getting the people that were vaccinated and people that weren't vaccinated. You think that we've learned enough from this that we can get a much more consistent message for the next one of these? And, I find it interesting. The prediction is that COVID is the beginning of others. And there have been others, actually, not to the extent that COVID has been, but certainly enough to have a lot of problems. It didn't spread as far and as fast as COVID, perhaps. But I thought that inconsistent sources of data help compound the problem. What is your thoughts about that?
Yeah, I think this kind of goes back to the point you were making earlier about pharmaceuticals. Anybody with an agenda has an ability to push that agenda. I think there are lots of reasons why people may choose to vaccinate or choose not to vaccinate. And there's some people who just, for whatever set of reasons, can't. And that's why reaching herd immunity is so important. I think about a conversation that I had with my own father, who refused to vaccinate for a long time, who ended up in the emergency room because his pulse ox was basically down to 90. And he ended up recovering and was fine. And one of my sister-in-laws said to him, "Ralph, I'm about to get my booster shot. She's gonna go to the county clinic. If you'd like to come with me, this is the day and the time that I'm leaving." And I was on my way, heading up north, about to visit friends in Chicago before going back home to Atlanta, or to back home to Cleveland, where my family lives. And my dad's like, "I gotta get the shot. Sarah's not gonna let me go to Christmas if I don't get the shot." And I'm sitting here going, "Oh my God, how am I gonna have this conversation with my father?" Because he's like, "Well, you're inside of CDC. Which one's best?" And I was like, "Dad, they're all kind of equally the same, but you probably maybe want to go with the two-shot one." I probably should have put him toward the one-shot one, but anyway. But we're driving, and so I'm having this conversation, answering all of my father's questions, and he can be a very stubborn man. And then finally, I had to think about what would get my father motivated. And I was listening to him, and he said to me, "Well, if I get this one, my arm's just going to become a pincushion. There's going to be no end to this." And if there's one thing I know about my father, it is that he cannot be perceived as being less macho than one of his kids, especially not his youngest daughter. And so, he's complaining about having to get, maybe two or three shots in the arm. So I just said, "Dad, how many shots do you think I had before I went to Baghdad?" And then he shut up. And he got the shot. But it took a better part of an hour.
Yes.
Listening to all sorts of permutations. So to add to your question, nobody could have thought in a uniform message to 75-year-old men in the Midwest ask them that. And that was what will get them to get the shot. Yeah.
So we have a tradition, which is for the last question, instead of we asking you, you have to ask a question to Ed.
To Ed?
Yeah.
Ed, what from the conversation we just had and from everything else that's happening this week at HL7, what are you going to take home with you? What's the message that you think you're seeing differently here than you've seen in the last? I mean, you've been to pretty much every single one of these. So what's different now?
That's a tougher question than I normally get.
Yeah, that's a tougher question we had.
I think what I'm taking home is HL7 is beginning to open its scope of interest. And part of that is there's this new thing called artificial intelligence. And there must be some need for HL7 standards related to that. And I think what we're trying to do is to understand how we can contribute to that area. Mm-hmm. I think the other thing is that to some extent, we're beginning to open a vision of who we need to communicate with. When HL7 started, all of the people that were interested in HL7 were the same, the people that understood the problem, the people that designed the standard, the people that implemented the standard, and the people that used the standard was all the same person, effectively. And that was V2. Yeah. And I think that's now changed. Yeah. And the emphasis between developing the standard and implementing the standard, where I think more of the activity is really an implementation, because you can make the most beautiful thing in the world, but sitting on the shelf doesn't really help society or not. And I think we're beginning to push that boundary out. And Diego, one of the most significant things that I have seen in recent years is Diego's spiral, because it really did open the door. And I keep pushing on Diego to let us get to number seven. Number seven is finally that user community.
Yeah.
And you're talking about, you know, Epic and Cerner, Oracle Cerner, and all those different EHR systems. And that's I'm arguing we need to get away from one size fits all. And I think the problem with the commercial EHRs today is they're doing a beautiful job, but you can't specialize it to individuals who need, with the huge amounts of data that we're collecting, and that's only beginning.
Yeah,
that we're going to collect more and more data, and we need to get smarter and how to be able to give you the right data at the right time about the right person. And I think that's one of the uses of artificial intelligence, is really how to do that, how to make those decisions making. How would you answer your own question?
Turning it back on me. I think I'm seeing a different composition of people at this meeting than the last work group meeting that I was at pre-pandemic. And I think it's because people are starting to feel that it's within reach. And so the work that this community does has such far-reaching implications. And I was glad to see Work Group Plus, because people like me who know these standards pretty well, but I'm not a coder and I don't have the patience or the disposition to sit and kind of work through the real fine-grained components of this. I have an appreciation for it, but could I do it for a week? I don't know, maybe not. But I think making it accessible by giving people information sessions, being able to say, okay, these are the people within my organization that I really need to have brought into these conversations, and just the willingness to help bring anybody up to speed, I think is what's great about this. It's a very different kind of organization. It's very grassroots oriented.
The other piece of this is face-to-face is infinitely better than virtual.
Yeah.
And I think that's one of the things that I'm really getting out of this particular meeting, is the fact that we got these pockets of conversation all around that has great content to those conversations. I mean, you and I have
had just sitting over breakfast. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think that's something that, you know, before the board had discussions as to whether we were going to be virtual.
All virtual.
Yeah. Oh, that would be, yeah.
Well, but it saves lots of money. If you think how much money is spent in travel and hotels and everything, yeah. But it's value that has to be considered. And I think the conversations about pushing virtual is going to diminish, if not disappear. And I think that's an important
thing. Yeah, recognize. How are you going to dance if it's virtual?
Okay, friends, this is the end. Thank you very much, Paula.
Thank you.